of the story, in addition to due and necessary consideration of the sexual element. In the days before reliable policing, a sojourner in a hostile land was dependent for his security and his life on the honesty and reliability of his hosts. This may have been particularly true in the Middle East, with its arid climate and vast stretches of desert intervening between cities. The trade routes that flourished and caravans that traveled there would not have been possible without the certainty that travelers could rely on their foreign hosts. The very architecture of houses and courtyards in the ancient cities of that area was designed with the intent to offer accommodation to strangers. This was true even of the infrastructure, water systems, plentiful churches for visitors passing through, and general layout, all designed with hospitality in mind. This ideal of hospitality was also an early expression of the doctrine that the foreigner is also of intrinsic value and best treated with kindness. There is no one who has made himself more vulnerable, after all, than the person who is under the roof of another man, particularly in a strange place. The moral requirement to extend kindness, consideration, and care is made explicit by the time of Leviticus. And if a stranger sojourn with thee in your land, ye shall not vex him, but the stranger that dwelleth with you shall be unto you as one born among you, and thou shalt love him as thyself, for ye were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Leviticus 19:33-34. The ensuing destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah occurs because God's inquiry into the conduct of people in that city reveals their extreme inhospitality, a sure sign of their complete moral collapse. They violate the principle of the gracious and secure provision of strangers, as well and in combination with their inhospitable and barren approach to sexuality itself. Now, one of the clear advantages of dealing with new people is that they may know how to do things you do not know how to do, and to possess knowledge you have not yet acquired. It is for such reasons that we are an inherently trading species, intrinsically interested in the mutually beneficial exchange of goods and services, as well as deeply communicative, prone to offer to the world, in other words, the fruit of our thoughts. This means that establishing a trusting and reciprocal relationship with an erstwhile stranger can bring all the resources of a foreign people to hand and provide the immense mutual enrichment that such contact can engender. There is, however, an associated danger. The unknown and apparently isolated and helpless man in your midst may well be very important to the other unknown people who value and love him, and only God knows how many of them there might be, or how powerful their forces. Thus, if a stranger is put at risk while discussing a trade deal, or for any other reason whatsoever, a very angry horde, or even an army, is likely to descend on the transgressor and everyone he loves, a fate that befell the marauding kings who purloined Lot and his people and provoked Abram to organize his forces, rescue them, and defeat the kidnappers. In 2023, I organized a 17-part seminar on the Book of Exodus. I invited about 10 people to participate directly, although another 10 to 20 were also involved on the filming, hosting, and production side. We set up a well-equipped local Airbnb in Miami to host everyone involved, held a dinner party with plenty of food and drink every night, and rented 2 jet skis for some daytime fun. This meant that we could all get to know one another, enjoy ourselves, analyze our temperaments and behaviors in a variety of situations. Each conversational topic is another situation. Test each other for humor, provoke, tease, share, commiserate, and speak freely together. Consequently, we came to trust one another much more, to discover a genuine pleasure in our mutual company, and to be much more likely to continue such discussion, even formally, if the opportunity to do so arose again in the future, as it did in the form of our soon-to-be-released seminar on the Gospels. This relationship building turned out to be something key to the project's success. We had to unexpectedly double its planned length because of the depth of the conversation, but this necessity was accepted, even welcomed, by everyone involved, in no small part because of the hospitality that had been both extended and accepted. Because our socializing also deepened our trust, it also made us more willing to push the boundaries in our more formal and recorded conversations, more able to listen deeply and to risk both challenging others and saying things in a manner that would have been far more unlikely in the absence of the accompanying social exchange. True hospitality enables the fundamental and basic sharing that truly unites us. We must all eat, drink, and talk, however casually, lightly, and entertainingly. If we can manage that in a spirit of goodwill, fellowship, and play, maybe we could risk more difficult ventures together. I have also witnessed what happens in the absence of that hospitality. This is particularly and dangerously true of the current situation in the political circles of Washington, D.C., where I have spent some very pointed time. For a variety of reasons, the elected officials who serve there are less and less likely to also live there. 4 out of 10 congressmen sleep in their offices. Let that sink in. This has radically decreased the probability that the familiarity and collegiality necessary for peaceful governance will make itself manifest. In addition, the introduction of cameras into the cardinal institutions of governance have turned places where discussion once occurred into public theaters instead of forums for mutual understanding and negotiation. Finally, the party brass on both sides discourage cross-party collaboration and interaction because of their belief that their people will become more difficult to predict and to control if they are consorting with the enemy. Now, because the congressmen and senators do not attend dinner or go for a drink together, because their children do not attend school or play baseball together, because they do not face the same local community together, the distrust across party lines has no chance to be ameliorated and every chance to grow, particularly when fanned by those who have decided to use fear, alienation, contempt, and force as their weapons of choice. Several years ago, I arranged a lunch for junior congressmen, Democrat and Republican alike, in an attempt to address the growing cross-party hostility. To get the ball rolling, every participant, there were about 20, introduced themselves and provided a 3-minute summary of their motivation for coming to D.C. It was an interesting anthropological venture. As a Canadian, I have always been impressed by the sheer theatricality and patriotism, both implicit and explicit, of Americans. This lunch was a jaunt through a sequence of micro-movies, various versions of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and it was impossible to tell the touchingly patriotic compatriots of one party from the other. Each in turn described the decision taken by themselves and their families to offer their service to their country in gratitude for all it had provided to them. Without exception, this was indicative of a genuine willingness to sacrifice. Everyone at that lunch, after such mutual disclosure, walked away feeling that they were now, if not among friends, because that takes more than one positive social interaction, at least among fellow Americans with whom much, if not almost everything of import, was truly shared. Without that operating at the superordinate level, which is the higher unity of national identity, all that is likely to manifest itself is political difference, and the apprehension of nothing but difference is dangerously similar to a state of genuine enmity. Thus, lack of opportunity for social interaction, lack of forum for hospitality, may pose a threat to the very sustainability of the state. This is no small problem, and nowhere near enough attention has been paid to it. In any case, it is because of the sacred importance of hospitality to the inhabitants of the Middle East that Lot acts in the manner that appears so strange to the modern sensibility and offers his daughters to the mob. Even that offer, by the way, indicates the relationship between the hospitality that is fertile versus the inhospitability, or worse, perverse hospitality that is barren. The men of Sodom are so thoroughly committed to mayhem and destruction, however, that they reject even this offer and attempt to storm the house. This is when they learn exactly what or who they are truly dealing with. The angels that Lot has unwittingly sheltered prove anything but defenseless. But the men put forth their hand and pulled Lot into the house to them and shut to the door. And they smote the men with blindness, great and small, so that they wearied themselves to find the door. Genesis 19:10-11. Why blindness, precisely? For everyone that asketh, it is said, receiveth, and he that seeketh, findeth, and to him that knocketh, it shall be opened. Matthew 7:8. What then of those who demand instead of asking, insist instead of seeking, and batter down the door instead of knocking, blinded instead by narrow lust and rage? They will find themselves unable even to find the way forward to fulfill their own self-defeating desires. What does this all mean? People can only sojourn along the path that is neither straight nor narrow for so long before they encounter the obstacle that cannot be circumvented, the pitfall that is truly deadly, or the dragon that cannot be defeated. There is an intrinsic moral order, as the biblical stories so continually insist, and its violation will result in punishment, no matter how avoided or delayed, and in precise proportion to the magnitude of sin involved. This stark fact, if fact it is, should give everyone who is tempted to stray in service of their own immediate desires pause of the most serious sort. Can we instead get away with absolutely everything? No one in their right mind believes that. The attempts of the men to wreak havoc on Lot's guests indicate that Sodom has deteriorated to the point where redemption is impossible and destruction certain. The angels therefore warn Lot to flee with his kin. His sons and sons-in-law fail to heed his warning and are later consumed by the fires. Lot is, by contrast, wise enough to listen. He escapes with his wife and his two daughters, who are famously warned neither to tarry as they journey forward, nor to look back. What does it mean to look back? When a tyrannical state collapses, a false nostalgia for the hypothetical certainties of the former totalitarian condition will invariably arise. Even now, a significant proportion of the Russian population still holds positive views, for example, of Stalin. According to the pollsters at Pew Research Center, almost 60% of adults in that country regard the man whose policies led to the death of some tens of millions of their countrymen more favorably than they do Mikhail Gorbachev, who presided over the USSR's final years and led the miraculously peaceful transition out of the communist catastrophe. This is particularly true of the elderly, who no doubt found the requirements of adaptation more disruptive and demanding, although that is no excuse given the extremity and pervasiveness of Stalin's barbarism. The same holds true in China with regard to the even more vicious Mao Zedong. Mao's image and legacy have been managed very carefully by the Chinese Communist Party, which presents that dread murderer as a national hero and architect of the forever glorious Chinese Revolution. Something very similar to the emergence of this counterproductive and blind nostalgia is portrayed in the story of Moses, initiated in the book of Exodus and continuing with Leviticus and Numbers. The Israelites, freed from the tyranny of Egypt, find it difficult at first to gain their feet. This reflected in the fact of their famed and otherwise mysterious wandering in the desert, and is a problem engendered in no small part by their own ungrateful, resentful, victimhood-claiming slavishness. Why does it take the Israelites 3 generations to traverse the small parcel of territory separating them from the promised land? Because those who are sufficiently confused and aimless can take forever to get nowhere at all. While moving forward to the promised land, the slavish escapees from Egypt whine and carp more or less continuously. One element of this is their constantly expressed longing for the comforts, much magnified in perverse memory, of their submission to the Pharaoh and his taskmasters. False nostalgia, as an escape from the realities and responsibilities of now, is an eternally present temptation. C.G. Jung warned of a similar danger on the psychological front. He described the phenomenon of regressive restoration of the persona in this regard. That false recovery is the attempt of a person once burned and hypothetically twice shy to ignore the learning of painful experience and to return to the blissful state of ignorance that previously prevailed. Christ warned as well in the gospel accounts of the danger of such self-defeating foolishness, particularly among people who, through bitter experience, should and even do know better. He that knew not and did commit things worthy of stripes shall be beaten with few stripes. Luke 12:48. In comparison, that servant which knew his Lord's will and prepared not himself, neither did according to his will, shall be beaten with many stripes. 12:47. The passage concludes with this dire warning: for unto whomsoever much is given, of him shall be much required, and to whom men have committed much, of him they will ask the more. Also Luke 12:48. Jung states in this regard: take as an example a businessman who takes too great a risk and consequently goes bankrupt. If he does not allow himself to be discouraged by this depressing experience, but, undismayed, keeps his former daring, perhaps with a little salutary caution added, his wound will be healed without permanent injury. But if, on the other hand, he goes to pieces, abjures all further risks, and laboriously tries to patch up his social reputation within the confines of a much more limited personality, doing inferior work with the mentality of a scared child in a post far below him, then technically speaking, he will have restored his persona in a regressive way. Formerly, perhaps he wanted more than he could accomplish. Now he does not even dare to attempt what he has it in him to do. The moral of the story? Do not look back at what you have left behind once you have learned to look forward in a better direction. Do not return to a road you have once trod when you have learned that it leads in a downward direction. Do not long for what you now recognize as evil or pay the price. Then the Lord rained upon Sodom and upon Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the plain and all the inhabitants of the cities and that which grew upon the ground. But his wife looked back from behind him and she became a pillar of salt. And Abraham got up early in the morning to the place where he stood before the Lord, and he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain, and beheld, and lo, the smoke of the country went up as the smoke of a furnace. And it came to pass, when God destroyed the cities of the plain, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in the which Lot dwelt. Exodus 19, 24 to 29. There is, in fact, a pillar of fossil salt known as Lot's wife in the vicinity of the Dead Sea at Mount Sodom in Israel. Perhaps it was the intermingling of the knowledge of the fact of that geographical feature with the creative imagination that gave rise to the story. That possibility does not in the least change its meaning. Two stories of sexual misconduct quickly follow. Lot's daughters first get their own father drunk and lay with him one night after the other, one daughter at a time. This story, in conjunction with the description of the fate of Lot's wife, indicates that the iniquity of Sodom was such that its repercussions continued to echo despite the destruction of the city itself, even among the wife and children of a hypothetically good man. Although we must remember that Lot had been tempted earlier in his life to pitch his tent, Genesis 13:12, toward Sodom. It is apparently very difficult for people to learn even a painfully object lesson, even when they have taken concrete steps to do so. Is it telling, as well, that the daughters of Lot offer yet another form of false hospitality? The story of lasting sin, or contamination thereby, does not end there. When Abraham journeys to Gerar, he once again pretends that Sarah is his sister, and she is once again taken by the king of the region, Abimelech by name. This duplication of deceptive act indicates something like a regression on Abraham's part and to the very pattern of behavior characterizing him at the beginning of his adventure. Was this also a consequence of his proximity to the evils of Sodom and Gomorrah? The sequence of events appears to suggest such a thing. God nonetheless objects to the purloining of Abraham's wife, appears to Abimelech in a dream, and warns him of the dire consequences to come. The now cautious king, who has fortunately not touched Sarah, claims innocence, upbraids Abraham, and restores Sarah to him, along with generous gifts of livestock and servants. Good relationships between the prophet, God, and the almost erring earthly ruler in question are reestablished. Furthermore, the fertility of the women of Abimelech's kingdom is restored, something that had been taken away because Sarah had been purloined. This all appears to mean at least two things. First, even the new Abraham apparently still finds himself haunted by the ghosts of his previous self, the temptations of his habitual misbehavior, his proclivity to lie when he is threatened, particularly through his wife. Each man has his typical and particularized weaknesses, often those that are the shadow side of his strengths. We will see something very similar when we come to the case of Moses, the archetypal leader, as Abram/Abraham is an example of the archetypal individual. Moses is constantly tempted by power. It is his true Achilles heel, a warning to would-be leaders everywhere, and the cause of the eventual insufficiency of his quasi-messianic mission. The loss of the fecundity of the women of Abimelech's polity and then its restoration, the second meaning, reflects the fact that the example posed by the community head will be duplicated by the common people. Thus, if the king goes astray in his sexual behavior, then so will everyone. And if the error is sufficiently egregious, reproduction will cease until the order that is truly reflective of divine will, so to speak, is reestablished. We might as well also inquire into why it is that even Abimelech, a great king, is threatened with punishment First, if he breaks a rule, given his status as undisputed ruler. And second, if it is a rule that he does not even know he is breaking, just as the later Egyptian pharaoh who tried the same is threatened. Remember the fate that befell Uzzah, who was destroyed when he put out a well-meaning hand to steady the Ark of the Covenant? The same principle applies here. Some rules are so fundamental that even the hypothetically powerful transgress against them at their great peril. Perhaps this is particularly true with regard to sexual conduct, given its grounding in the deepest of motivations and the vital importance of its regulation to the integrity of psyche and society alike. Transgression against the proper rules of physical intimacy, even when accidental or done in ignorance, are capable of destabilizing and destroying everything within a given person or polity. Paramount among these, according to the biblical tradition, are rules against fornication, sex out of wedlock, adultery, prostitution, incest, bestiality, and intrasexual congress. There is no reason to assume that such warning is arbitrary, let alone a matter of implicit or explicit prejudice. There are no relationships between people that are more delicate, more prone to cause conflict, and more necessary to maintenance and furthering of the intergenerational contract than those that are sexual. Thus, it stands to reason that sex must be regulated through custom and contract so that everyone knows where he or she stands and why. Everyone must come to understand in no uncertain terms how the most intense desire for immediate gratification must be bounded so that medium to long-term psychological health might be maintained and peaceful, productive, generous social interaction at the level of both couple and community is best ensured. But not only that, so that sex itself might thrive, fertility make itself manifest, individuals find love, and society stabilize and flourish. 6.7, the pinnacle of sacrifice. Sarah miraculously conceives at this point in the story, as God has promised. God then tells Abraham that the new son, Isaac, will be the father of his named descendants, although Hagar's child will also sire multitudes. It is immediately after this that the story takes its most infamous turn. God follows this happy news with an unimaginable announcement, telling Abraham that he must take this late and long-desired son, the consolation of the couple's old age, the very son delivered by God himself as reward for Abraham and Sarah's continual faithfulness, put him on the altar and immolate him in the most terrible possible sacrifice to God. And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham and said unto him, Abraham. And he said, Behold, here I am. And he said, Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. Genesis 22:1-2. How can a God who purports to stand for what is highest, to be more accurately that which is highest, demand such an apparently unholy thing? It is for this reason, and it makes perfect sense once properly explicated. All things, no matter how valuable, must be offered up to God. Christ reiterates and expands upon this principle much later when he says both this, if any man come to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whosoever doth not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. Luke 14:26-27. And this, and everyone that hath forsaken houses or brethren or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my name's sake shall receive a hundredfold and shall inherit everlasting life. Matthew 19:29. Michelangelo's famous Pietà dramatizes this idea in the visual form of what might well be regarded as the female equivalent of the crucifix. The sculptor carved this masterpiece, which now occupies a place of honor in St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, from a single block of marble when he was 23 years of age. It represents Mary, eternal mother of the Savior, contemplating in peace and humility the broken body of her crucified adult son. What is the meaning of this unforgettable work? It is this: the good mother offers up her child to be broken by the terrible world. It is the role of the properly sacrificial parent to encourage the child to act out his or her destiny, regardless of cost. And the cost is always suffering and death, remediated though it may be, at least in potential, by the true adventure of life. Is it not just as painful for a mother to give up her child to the world as it is to offer herself to fate and destiny? Or perhaps more so? Is there any love greater than the love willing to offer a child in sacrifice to what is truly highest? This is, of course, as true for father as it is for mother. And with that question and its answer, we can also see in the story of Abraham and Isaac the foreshadowing of the idea of the death of the Son of God. We are all sons and daughters of God, or so insist the stories constituting the biblical corpus. And if these stories are not about us, and this is a serious question for atheists as well as believers, then who or what could they possibly be about? And how could it not be that the willingness to sacrifice even what is most dear to that which is yet better serves as the antithesis of the resentment that embitters and corrupts, given that there is necessarily no more extreme possible expression of gratitude? It is a psychoanalytic truism attributed to Austrian-born British psychoanalyst Melanie Klein that the good mother necessarily fails. This failure is the polar opposite of the attitude of the devouring mother, whose perverse success at doing everything for her beloved child can easily become his or her most dangerous and destructive foe. The good mother is willing to sacrifice her child to God, partly because her service to what is highest must necessarily take priority, precisely because the lower should never be superordinate to the higher, and partly because it is also in following God, by definition, that her child can find his or her redemption. God himself does the same with his son, a sacrifice played out as the passion of Christ, an offering and transformation that brings about the end of the dominion of death, harrows hell, and reconciles the sinful progeny of Adam to their heavenly father. It should be remembered, too, that Abraham gets his son back in consequence of offering him to God. What does this mean? The best way to truly obtain and to keep the beloved child long promised by God is to offer him or her up to the Spirit that calls to the adventure of life, that is eternal counsel to the wise, that is the logos that eternally broods over the potential that is endlessly deep. The gospel lines pertaining to the necessity of foregoing even family for God follow closely on the heels of a story with a similar moral, the parable of the rich man who has everything earthly he needs, but still feels an unrequited longing in his soul. And everyone that hath forsaken houses, or brethren, or sisters, or father, or mother, or wife, or children, or lands, for my name's sake, shall receive a hundredfold, and shall inherit everlasting life. Matthew 19:29. This is not a diatribe against wealth, as commonly presumed. It is for this reason that those who follow the commandments of Abraham from Abel forward are typically blessed with material prosperity and abundance, in keeping with the idea that the proper habitation of man and woman is a fruitful garden. It is the love of money, not money itself, that constitutes an impediment to the climbing of Jacob's ladder. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have, for he himself has said, "I will never desert you, nor will I ever abandon you." Hebrews 13:5, New American Standard Bible. Money itself is only a token of exchange and promise, and when used honestly, a positive good. Raising the desire for material wealth to the position of the highest good, precisely what the Israelites do in the story of Exodus when they determine to worship the golden calf, is another thing altogether. Intellect, in its proper place, sex, in its proper place, and wealth and material prosperity, in its proper place. When out of order, however, particularly when falsely elevated to the highest place, something that could be good can become a terrible master. This occurs in precise but inverse proportion to its potential for that good when it has been properly subdued and named. There is also a fundamental promise in such lines that the eventual reward is directly proportional to the sacrifice. If it was otherwise, of course, no exceptional sacrifice would ever be advisable. If every painful and upward-aiming offering was rejected, there would be no point in conscientious laboring or striving forward. I have watched such reward make itself manifest in the lives of many people I have had the privilege to observe. I saw, for example, and firsthand, what happened to people who said what they believed to be true and put their reputations and careers on the line to do so. The mob came for them, sure enough, and they paid precisely the non-trivial short-term cost that those who remain silent or lie outright scheme to avoid. But those who maintained faith in the truth invariably succeeded. Not immediately, and there's the rub. But eventually. Sometimes reward came in the provision of opportunities from people who were impressed to the point of action by the very real sacrifices they observed. Sometimes it was a consequence of a profound psychological reorientation attendant on living through and withstanding the firestorm of controversy that followed their disavowal of security in the name of truth. Sometimes it was both. This is akin to the material abundance enjoyed by Abraham and Sarah, and to the renewal of their identity, represented by their renaming, the beneficial fate shared by the Jacob who becomes Israel. There is literally nothing more practical than the proper sacrifices to what is highest, and there is simultaneously no limit to the demand for sacrifice. Hence, the offering of Isaac, and later, Jesus of Nazareth. This pragmatic assertion can be regarded as a simple matter of priority. What is first must come first, no matter what and no matter who. This is in no small part because there will be situations in life, often of great tragedy and import, when the presence of material wealth will prove of no utility. In such cases, it is only the proper upward orientation, away from despair and bitterness, that can play a necessary salvific role. Divorces are common among the rich as well as the poor, as poverty adds stress to the complex problem of maintaining a proper marital relationship, and wealth offers only limited protection against both aging and illness. Money can directly abet sin, too. I had many clients in my clinical practice who, on receiving their monthly unemployment or disability benefit were swarmed by their ne'er-do-well parasitical friends, happy to spend precisely that windfall, leaving said clients all too often face down in a ditch or its equivalent after a three-day binge. It is for such reasons that Christ, therefore, so directly insists, "Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal." Matthew 6:19-20. Earthly treasures are palpably material, including even such necessities as food and water. But Christ contrasts the heavenly bread with its insufficient material equivalent, describing the pattern of attentional prioritization and action he represents as the source of eternal food. "I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If any man eat of this bread, he shall live forever. And the bread that I give is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world." John 6:51. How best to store resources? The proper answer to that question is in genuine reputation, because then everyone springs to your aid when the storms come, including you. "For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." Matthew 6:20. This is the reiteration of the second promise that the spirit of adventure that is God makes to Abram when the initial covenant that binds the two is formulated, when Abram decides to stop being a dependent, whiny coward and aim up. "I will bless thee and make thy name great." Genesis 12:2. This heavenly storehouse of value is something more abstracted and intangible than material wealth per se, something more a consequence of higher order spiritual striving, though even money is essentially nothing but a signifier of this heavenly reality, as its value is nothing in the final analysis, but mutual promise. If you endeavor above all to treat your neighbor as yourself, for example, Matthew 22:29, or even to love your enemies, Matthew 5:44, that commitment will manifest itself in what you attend to and how you act, and other people will observe that and respond in kind. It is the garnering of this abstract, transcendent, or heavenly form of treasure that is, of course, the aim of the great prophets and all those who live by the highest standards, and the truly imperishable and incorruptible gold. The story of Abraham and Isaac carries within it a paradoxical promise. If a parent is willing to sacrifice his or her child to God, acting out that willingness in every micro glance and action, then the child will not be sacrificed or otherwise destroyed by the very hand of that parent who might otherwise be tempted to do so, if doing so redounds in some pathological manner to their moral credit. It is not such a rare occurrence for parents to cripple their children so that they can make a public show of their martyrdom and compassionate virtue. "Sure, I am cursed with a monster, but look how well I am bearing up under the burden. Look how much love I am still able and willing to pour out." This is the terrible aim of the witch in the forest, much too good to be true, in her gingerbread house, who conspires to devour Hansel and Gretel when they are abandoned by their father. "Fatten them up, then eat them." The full Oedipal nightmare in all its terrible reality. This is the catastrophe of the maternal instinct gone dreadfully wrong, the horror of compassion when it is inappropriately put in the highest place, the full manifestation of the prideful sin of Eve. Both sides of this story can hardly be dramatized emphatically enough. It is a terrible thing to offer son or daughter to God, but it is a positively hellish thing, an offering to the darkest abyss, to fail to do so. The parent who, for example, protects his or her child at all costs, thereby maintaining past its due date an increasingly corrupt and counterproductive infantilism, is simultaneously and often purposefully compromising that child's soul, dooming him or her to an everlasting insecurity, anxiety, hopelessness, and most bitter resentment and self-hatred. If you, as a parent, are willing instead to offer your son or daughter to God, to the destiny that is both true and terrible, then you may be fortunate enough not to be complicit in his or her death, bodily or spiritual. And the angel of the Lord called unto him out of heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here am I." And he said, "Lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do thou anything unto him. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me." Genesis 22:11-12. The spirit that is God in the Abrahamic story is not only the still small voice that calls to adventure, it is also the same unitary spirit requiring those who welcome its presence to go all in, to risk everything. Optimal adaptation requires that no light is left languishing under a bushel, that nothing within is held in abeyance, that all potential strength is mustered for the fight, that all resources are brought to bear on the problems at hand. Is that surprising, given the ultimate seriousness and difficulty of life? When life itself is on the line, everything must be given. What stone can possibly be left unturned when the task that faces us is the dragon of chaos, the burden of death, the eternal reality of evil? It is therefore by necessity that God is the Father who will even and eternally sacrifice his own Son to that which is truly holy. And paradoxically, it is by means of that ultimate sacrifice, stalwartly undertaken by that very Son, that salvation and redemption is always and forever brought about. The Son is set right by the Father, willing to do the right thing no matter what, even at the cost of everything he loves. The Son is set right and sets everyone else right, not least by example, by his willingness to abide by the dictates of the Father who loves him, and who is thereby willing to face even that which will destroy him and drag him to hell. Thus, the God of action and adventure is also he who requires the ultimate sacrifice, but paradoxically is least likely to demand it if it is truly offered. Abraham and Sarah are elderly and rich. Isaac is their only son, promised by God and delivered after many pitfalls and very late in life. So they have every reason to dote counterproductively on the scion they have labored so long to produce, and in doing so, to devour him. They could very easily have justified to themselves the necessity of the very excess of care, really narrowly self-centered desire, that would have made of their privileged and fortunate son a truly narcissistic piece of work, a true spiritual descendant of Cain and Luciferian spirit. Instead, Abraham and Sarah continue to act forthrightly and subordinate all that is lesser to that which is greater. They live their lives in the comprehensive and complete manner that grants them the adventure that perhaps justifies their suffering, that maybe atones for the great crime of their existence. They each live to a great age. And Sarah was 107 and 20 years old. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died in Kirjath Arba, the same as Hebron in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Genesis 23:1-2. And these are the days of the years of Abraham's life, which he lived, 103 and 15 years. Then Abraham gave up the ghost and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people. Genesis 25:7-8. Did their lives justify the terrible limitations of mortal being? That is the promise of abiding by the true unitary animating spirit whose character is delineated in the great biblical corpus of dramatic stories. Their adventure is not the mere dwelling in the paradise of infantile satiation, nor is it the pointless repetitive toil of the same damned thing over and over. It is instead a very sophisticated promised land, a sequence of journeys to better and better places, with each journey a more and more compelling adventure, resulting in the fullest of all possible lives, and the echoing of that fullness and completion across the generations and into the distant future. It is the life that all of us could and should live if we had the courage and the adventure that would perhaps justify the fact of our fragility and mortal limitation. Chapter 7. Moses 1. God as dreadful spirit of freedom. 7.1. The Jews as unwelcome sojourners and slaves. We encounter the Israelites in the book of Exodus when they are in Egypt, but no longer under the protection established for them by Joseph, the son of Rachel and Jacob, who had saved the whole country from starvation. In the aftermath of that triumph and the goodwill that it produced, the kinsmen of Joseph had thrived, and the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty, and the land was filled with them. Exodus 1:7. Instead of being properly grateful for this aid and the provision of the labor of the Israelites, the Pharaoh who succeeds Joseph's sovereign ally begins to view the Israelites as a threat. Behold, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass, when there falleth out any war, they join also our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Exodus 1:10. What might we note here? First, the ancient Jews have the temerity to be successful, even though they are strangers in a strange land. Second, those who agitate against the Israelites foster hatred against them as a potential fifth column and justify this aggression as preemptive self-protection. Some things truly never change. The Jews have existed as the prototypical successful minority for millennia. Why? Perhaps a culture of literacy, schooling, and ambitious disciplined striving conjoined with true admiration for such endeavor. Perhaps something approximating intra-group sexual and cultural selection for high intelligence. Such ideas are perennially unpopular. What is the alternative explanation? The accusations that comparative success is due to perfidy or conspiracy in the form of prejudicial intergroup favoritism and unfair manipulation? This has been the age-old accusation, as evidenced not least in the opening of Exodus. The Egyptians enviously reduced their once benefactors, the successful minority, to slavery. This is another manifestation of the spirit of Cain. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and in brick and in all manner of service in the field. Exodus 1, 13 to 14. When such oppression proves insufficient to break their spirit, the Pharaoh commands the Hebrew midwives to kill all the boys they are charged with delivering at their birth. A thematically similar threat is echoed much later in the time of Christ. Then Herod, when he saw that he was mocked of the wise men, was exceeding wroth, and sent forth and slew all the children that were in Bethlehem and in all the coasts thereof from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had diligently inquired of the wise men. Matthew 2:16. Herod had been warned that a king would be born to the Jews and threaten his reign, and took this action to forestall that threat. Something analogous is portrayed in the story of King Arthur. King Vortigern, Arthur's uncle, is the evil brother to the latter's father, Cain to his Abel. That king was warned, as was Herod, that a recently born child would one day rise to overthrow him. All three of these stories rely on the plot device of the hero endangered at birth, a common narrative trope. Why would the redeeming hero be portrayed as vulnerable at birth and the tyrant represented as infanticidal? Not least because all human beings, even those who grow up to triumph, are comparatively helpless as infants and young children, exposed as they must be to the depredations of nature and society. The pre-industrial infant mortality rate was 1 in 4. The child mortality rate, 50%. Further, direct infanticide was far from uncommon, cross-culturally or in absolute numbers. Anthropologist Joseph Birdsall estimates that between 1/6 and half of children in prehistoric times met their end in that manner. And what is the risk of danger now to those who would be born if it were not for the abortion, touted so deceptively when first made accessible as safe, legal, and rare? Those were, and are, the direct threats. More indirectly, and perhaps even more pervasively, all journeys begin with the first and often tentative steps, and all great men start small. And who else would the tyrant kill but the world-redeeming hero whose intrinsic mission is in some part the overthrow of the power mad? And all such heroes make their beginning as the divine child. Moses is born to a Hebrew mother during the period of danger decreed by the Egyptian Pharaoh. She hides him from the murderous authorities for 3 months. Then, unable to continue the deception, she makes a little raft for him of bulrushes and places him on the river. Exodus 2, 1-10. This is the first of many episodes associating the eventual leader of the Israelites with water in both its life-giving and destructive manifestations, contrasted with the unyielding and unmalleable stone signifying Egypt. The very name of Moses signifies his affinity with the liquid that gives life, Exodus 1:10. Like God himself, the eventual prophet is a master of chaos, of possibility, of the tohu vabohu, the primordial water over which the word of God broods at the beginning of time and always, the water that finds its course inevitably as it wends its way downhill, the water whose persistence can wear away even the hardest stone. This motif of stone versus water is extended to the later desert sojourn as well, where Moses displays his ability to transform even the rocks of the wasteland into life-giving springs. Exodus 17:6, Numbers 20:7 to 12. This represents the fact that leadership in the right spirit can make even the desert bloom. The Pharaoh's daughter sees Moses on the water, identifies him as one of the threatened children, but decides to rescue and raise him as her own son. Exodus 2:1 to 10. She calls on a nursemaid to provide him with sustenance and care. Unbeknownst to her, Moses' true mother steps forward to do so. This is another mythological trope. The hero with dual ancestry, one set of the divine or semi-divine protagonist's parents is common or earthly, the other kingly, magical, or divine. J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter has the Dursleys, for example, and his actual mother and father, a witch and wizard of renown. Superman, the hero of DC Comics, has the earthly Kents, but also his true parents on the alien planet of his birth, and thus in heaven. Disney's Sleeping Beauty is raised in a forest, away from her rightful kingdom, just like the young King Arthur, who spends his childhood tutored by Merlin among the common people. A common fantasy of unhappy children is, similarly, that they are orphans abandoned by a mother and father who will someday reappear and rescue them. The use of such motifs is staggeringly common in the literary domain. What do these literary themes imply? That every human being is a child of nature and culture, or of nature and God, even more so than of his or her own parents. That every child grows up alienated from his or her rightful kingdom, ensconced for some time among those too common to realize their true destiny or ancestry. That every child will be enticed by fear to hide his or her light under a bushel to disguise what is best about them, to avoid the attention of the tyrants who might otherwise be jealously provoked. And that the one true king must realize his transcendent parentage and grow in consequence to take his proper place of ultimate responsibility and destiny, as Simba does, for example, in Disney's The Lion King. The dual parentage motif also dramatizes the fact that with maturity we must cease laying responsibility for the existential conditions of life at the feet of our parents and assign it instead to the broader forces of biology and society. This realization better enables individuals to lift the burden of blame for the iniquities of life from their parents, insofar as that is possible, given a just apportioning of causal attribution. This means to transfer both dependency on and allegiance to away from the earthly father, so to speak, to the heavenly father, and to do the same with regard to mother and nature. The advantage? In terms of maturity? Once a man is responsible to God, he will no longer feel compelled to labor under the thumb, or indeed the sins, of his father, or to take shelter under the wing of his mother. The same is, of course, true of women. When Moses reaches maturity, he encounters an Egyptian beating an enslaved Hebrew, Exodus 2:11 to 14. He takes great offense to this act, regarding it as unjust and unwarranted, and kills the perpetrator. This decision to stand on the side of the oppressed is a manifestation of a particular vision of leadership, the full significance of which is revealed only in the New Testament. That what is truly sovereign serves mercy and justice, supports those in peril, and forswears the advantages of arbitrary and undeserved power and lineage. particularly when that has become tyrannical. This is a true transformation of understanding. It is much simpler to assume that both position and might make for justifiable privilege and true right. This nonetheless murderous act is also something that both foreshadows and directly indicates Moses' fatal flaw, the tendency to employ force when it is not strictly necessary, and to do so somewhat impulsively. What does this mean? No less than that temptation of power inevitably accompanies the responsibility of leadership, even among the greatest of men. It proves, in the final analysis, to be the great prophet's Achilles heel. Numbers 20:7-12. In consequence of this act, Moses finds it necessary to flee from Egypt, learning that knowledge of what he has done is spread, fearing, and rightfully so, the Pharaoh's vengeance. Exodus 2:15. He journeys to a foreign land, Midian, resting when he arrives by the side of a well. This is another example of his relationship with the water that transforms, renews, and replenishes. There he meets the daughters of a local priest who are being harassed and interfered with in their attempts to draw water by a group of shepherds. Moses chases the ruffians away and then draws water for the young women and their flock. Exodus 2:16-17. Moses therefore does for Midian's daughters in miniature what he eventually does for his entire people. This is brilliant and subtle foreshadowing. The daughters of Midian return home and tell their father what transpired at the well. He encourages them to find Moses and offer him a seat at the family table. This hospitality works out well for Moses, who cannot yet return to Egypt. He stays with Jethro, the Midian priest, and marries Zipporah, one of his daughters. Jethro later plays a key role in Moses' work, and, in a manner emphasizing his wise and caring nature. It is often the case in the biblical corpus and in literature more generally that the foreigner can stand for the wisdom that remains in the world when the home state has become corrupt. 7.2. The fiery tree as revelation of being and becoming. Back in Egypt, the Pharaoh dies, although the Israelites remain in bondage, crying to God in their misery. God hears these cries and remembers the covenant he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, noting in doing so that the Israelites have not lost faith. Meanwhile, Moses remains in exile, minding his own business. We might consider the erstwhile prophet content, at least for the moment. He is away from Egypt and its tyranny and slavery. He has slipped from the constraints of his own past, from the complexity of his dual heritage and juvenile misadventures. He is free from any danger of pursuit or revenge, happy in love, and surrounded by people who admire his courage and have determined to share their lives with his. He has, in short, established himself successfully as an adult with all the attendant responsibilities and advantages. More specifically and tellingly, Moses has become a shepherd, taking care of Jethro's flocks. The biblical shepherd is a type of hero, as we have seen in chapter 3. He must face trying circumstances, alone with his flock, establish the way forward, keep the wolves and lions at bay, and, more generally, provide the care for the least of these, see Matthew 25:31-46, that is the hallmark of truly legitimate authority. Moses has become a man in the typical manner, successfully negotiating the transition from impulsive youth to responsible, although still somewhat ordinary, adult. That is indeed a step forward and a true accomplishment, but it is insufficient. One day, Moses is leading his sheep through the desert when he comes near the mountain of God, even to Horeb, Exodus 3:1. This Horeb is also Mount Sinai, which is the eternal place of Jacob's ladder, the place where heaven reaches down and earth extends upward to meet it, the place where the narrative and the material worlds touch, the place of significant coincidence or synchronicity, where events fall into a meaningful pattern, the place where the magical, miraculous, or transcendent reveals itself within the imminent in the manner insisted upon in Matthew 7:7-8. Ask, and it shall be given you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For everyone that asketh receiveth, and he that seeketh findeth, and to him that knocketh it shall be opened. Also, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hear my voice and open the door, I will come in to him and will sup with him, and he with me. Revelation 3:20, Christ speaking. The connection between Jacob's ladder and Mount Sinai was made explicit in certain medieval midrashim, the traditional Jewish commentaries on the Torah, in two ways. First, conceptually, as the ladder is in fact the structure that connects the spiritual world, or heaven, to the material world, or earth, and is in that manner the equivalent of the liana, or the tree, that unites the two realms in the much more archaic and ancient Neolithic shamanic understanding. Second, from the perspective of numerology, as the number of the letters of the word ladder are equivalent to those of Sinai, or the Hebrew equivalents, and were therefore deemed equivalent in meaning. We can picture Moses alone in contemplation, taking note of something anomalous, something that appeals to his curiosity, to his adventurous spirit. It beckons to him at the edges of his attention. He decides to investigate, to walk off the beaten path, and to see what lies beyond the day-to-day and predictable, what still remains outside the mere normal goodness of his now well-established life. What does this indicate? No less than that Moses, and therefore the leader, as Moses is the archetypal leader, is he who attends voluntarily to his calling. A calling is perhaps best understood as a manifestation, both proximal and tangible, of the eternal covenant between God and his people. Why phrase it like that? Not least because that is how the phenomenon, from the Greek phainestai, to shine forth, manifests itself. We all have problems that beset us, obsess us, will not leave us alone, will not leave us in peace, call to us to attend to and investigate. Insoluble mysteries and impassable obstacles litter the landscape. Why are we possessed by certain concerns and not others? Is it because some problems happen to be our problems, our responsibilities? And we are called by ineluctable instinct either to address them or to be plagued by them without end. Who is to say? It is certainly as accurate, existentially or phenomenologically, to note that our problems choose us as much as the reverse. Not only do they choose us, but they often literally will not leave us alone. Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight. Why the bush is not burnt. And when the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here am I. Exodus 3:1-4. The branching form of a bush or tree is a standard symbol of life. Hence, most famously, the tree of life. Fire, for its part, as the bush is burning, is a manifestation of transformation. It is also something permanently numinous and intrinsically attractive, dancing as it does constantly on the edge of predictability in its musical manner, compelling attention, both conscious and unconscious, and inviting the interaction that has made human beings masters of fire instead of victims to its power. A burning bush is, therefore, an amalgam of three things: being,